Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2022, September 16. I am John Pasmino. Our topic today is New York Skies, that's three separate words, in fall 2022. I mean the skies of New York area, not the name of our astronomy advocacy group, New York Skies. You have both files, you better, for the presentation. You're listening to the audio file. You need the video file with the slideshows. If you missed it, go to www.nyskies.org. On the home page, there are jump words, one of which is audio video files, and you punch on that. You're now on the AV files page. It tells you why you need the both files, since one without the other is nonsense. Then they also tell you about the New York Skies email group, where you can discuss astronomy with the other members, both within and beyond New York Skies. Following the text are the links to about a year and a half worth of the digital New York Skies Astronomy Seminar. And the one you're looking for is near the bottom, which is titled New York Skies in Fall 2022. And you can download the PPT video file. Okay, I assume you did that and you're standing on slide one. There was no quiz from the Jupiter session in early September. I did explain, among other things, where we got our word satellite from. And some of you came back and asked, oh, come on, and you're pulling our leg. That's a silly reason, and so on. So here is, in slide one, an entry from an online Latin dictionary. Now, when Galileo found that the little stars sitting next to Jupiter stayed with the planet, even though the planet moved downrange in the zodiac, that proved a couple of things. One, objects can orbit other objects besides the Earth, and two, the objects in orbit around the other body, Jupiter, which was moving, could not be left behind. Remember an argument that the Earth had to stand still because if it moved, the moon would be left behind. So he called these little stars satellites, which in Latin, and I guess Italian too, means an attendant or a companion. So here is the dictionary entry for satellus, which is a singular, and as in any Latin dictionary, we also give the genitive or possessive, which you're familiar with that from constellations, satellitus. The reason we do that is the root or the base of the genitive is the part of the word that we use to add additional endings for the various uses in a sentence. For instance, satellites with an ES at the end is simply the plural of satellis. Okay, it gives you the declension, which if you don't know Latin, you can forget that. The gender, it's common in the sense that you may choose it in a particular piece of writing as masculine or feminine. Then it gives the definitions. Okay, an accomplice, an abettor, so a helper essentially. Then you have assistant, companion, follower, and then the last one there is lifeguard. Now, in this sense, we would call that a bodyguard, a person who stays near you to protect you, as someone who goes out to you in distress to rescue you. That's what we call lifeguards at a beach, typically. You get in trouble out there beyond the breakers, the guy jumps off his chair, makes a beeline out there, throws a ring out to you, whatever. But now this is a guy who has a bulge on his upper chest. No, it's not a moob. And if there's any trouble brewing where you're in danger, he reaches into his shirt and pulls out his Glock to defend you. So it was and is an ordinary word, and it means one of those meanings, and certainly that's what the satellites of Jupiter look like they were doing. And then as we discovered satellites around other planets, the name stuck. And of course, artificial satellites around the Earth are those which, well, accomplish a battery because they fulfill different terrestrial functions, communications, surveillance, weather monitoring, and so on. But that's, so I didn't just make up that silly story. It's the real answer. The title slide is in slide number 2. And, okay, you have the title, the date, and blah, blah. Summarize the AV file page. Actually, it gives the inverse, because if a friend gave you the video file and you don't have the audio, it sends you back to the AV files page to pull down the MP3 half of the presentation. But now, after the text are supplemental readings which will amplify the lesson. The first one is dso-ny.htm, and that is a breadbasket list of deep sky objects. It was tailored for observing in New York, but it's valid for any place in the northern latitudes around the world in an urban environment, because all the objects in this list were actually observed within the precincts of New York City. Now, obviously not necessarily from the center of Times Square. Well, you don't get much of a sky because of the tall buildings, but could have been in the outlying areas, like the bedroom districts. But in any case, the air is grayish. We do not get sixth magnitude sky stars in the city, but that will give you a very good selection of objects, especially for new people into the profession. The next one, plan star for planetary star, is a distinct and separate list for planetary stars. Stars having their own sets of planets called extrasolar planets or exoplanets. The list is limited to bare-eye stars, of which there's around 110 throughout the sky. And that covered the whole hemispheres, the north and south. So that becomes another category of deep sky object. There's a skinnier list within DSO-NY, but PlanSTAR gives you the full set of those planetary stars. The next one there is SUSPSUM, SUSPSUMM, standing for Suspended Summer. And that is a curious phenomenon in the fall, which is typified by the summer triangle. That asterism, plus the stars now surrounding it, seems to linger and linger and linger all the way to the end of the year when winter is beginning, even though it is a summer constellation group. And this explains why that effect occurs. It is complementary to the swan dive effect in the spring when Orion, Canis Minor, Taurus, which were gently moving away in the west, suddenly plunge into evening twilight, seemingly within a few weeks. But that explains why that happens. The next is Milky-NY, meaning Milky Way in New York. Well, we mentioned the gray skies in connection with the first article, DSO-NY, but a sky can become, in the spring and in the fall, like right now, clear enough in various parts of New York City that the brightest segments of the Milky Way do show through. They'll look like weak patches, but they're aligned with the path of the Milky Way in the sky. And that shows you why that happens and some of the preparations for looking for the Milky Way. And I'll mention it during the presentation. The Milky Way fall season, the window within which a better chance to see the Milky Way is September, October, and November. The spring season is May and June. The last one, Aurora NY, for Aurora in New York, shows the precautions to take and the tests to do for suspicious glows in the sky, which could be northern lights. Of course, everything there is applicable for any other gray sky district or an area which has terrestrial illuminations. Okay, so now we plow into slide number 3. Autumn in many parts of the U.S., certainly around New York City, and the eastern coast from southern New England all the way to Florida, and then wrapping around into the Gulf Coast out to Texas, is hurricane territory. The hurricanes spawn in late summer, early fall in the middle or the Caribbean Atlantic Ocean, and they migrate toward the U.S. and either track along the coastlines or go plow inland. And while they can give short periods of cloudy skies, there's a much greater hazard where it just disrupt normal daily life by mainly three methods. One is wind, winds up to 150 or 200 kilometers per hour, so all light structures will be blown down or even blown, carried away. And rain, torrential rains, they say 100 centimeters per hour in some cases, which will simply soak the ground, loosen trees, overfill drainage systems, flood over pools and reservoirs. And then three, you have storm surge. If you're located near a waterfront, then the ocean or the bay will be heaved upwards several meters, and you would get a general flooding of a kilometer or more inland, which is a disaster. So there are those three basic hazards which will last for weeks, months, and in some cases even a year. That is the cleanup and recovery that take that long. So that's the hazards of fall, even though we typically are rid of the humid, dank, torrid air and cooler, drier, clearer air comes in, you have the hurricane hazard. By now, fall 2022, the COVID episode is essentially gone. There are very few mandated masks, social distancing, quarantine, getting 15 booster shots and all of that. However, in slide 4, we do see lingering efforts to encourage getting the vaccinations, and sadly enough, some companies are still firing or otherwise docking workers who do not get the specified number of vaccination shots. Same thing with a lot of civil or public servants. Some agencies will simply give you a pink slip if you say no to vaccination. But besides COVID, new threats could come down the track. Polio erupted in many parts of the United States. Lyme's disease, Legionnaire's disease, Ebola, monkeypox, tuberculosis, some being contagious and some being transmitted by some very intimate contact, and others can be dispersed in the air. So your local health department or your medical advisor and provider can advise you how to deal with these potential threats and what preventives you can take and what precautions that you can practice to avoid them. But this is coming in the fall period, and this may roll out through the end of the year. Okay, so we now look up at the autumn sky in slide 5. Now, when we say autumn stars or autumn sky or stars of September or July or a month, the general meaning is that that band of stars south through overhead and beyond in the north to the North Star, I'm talking of course about the Northern Hemisphere, are in view at nightfall. So when the twilight is about over with, say 40 or so minutes after sunset, whatever is in that north-south band is stars of that night or that month or that season. we will see here, we are looking south, and the zenith overhead is about one third down from the center top of the map. Stars on the right toward the west, and the horizon arc has compass points around it, are stars typically of summer. And in fact, you see there the large triangle starting from the right margin, Vega, though in going roughly 8 o'clock from Vega, we have Altair, and then going up 12 to 1 o'clock, we come to Deneb, and to 4 o'clock from Deneb, back to Vega, and in the middle of that is the star Albireo, and they are summer stars. Ras Al Haig is also well up in the sky. That's an Ophiuchus. In the east, on the left, we've got Capella and El Nas in the winter sky, the Pleiades and the Hyades, typical winter stars. They are moving into view. Now, September, October are favorite times for home astronomers to view the winter stars while the weather and the air conditions are still pleasant. If you wait until winter onset of nightfall, and the winter stars are in the south, it can be cold, it can be windy, the ground can be filled with snow, it can be icy, and you could get wind-blown ice from nearby trees hitting you. So by waiting a few hours, this is for 21 hours standard time in November, we'll worry about the daylight and standard time later, and if you wait 3 more hours toward midnight, the eastern stars will rise higher, so you get Orion, all of Taurus, most of Eridanus, and parts of Gemini coming into view. Of course, the summer stars will have set. Vega and Altair will probably be setting. Deneb will move into the northeast, and the autumn stars will be shoving over toward the area of the summer triangle in this view. That's the diurnal rotation of the sky, and it's a good trick to see the next season's stars in a pleasant surround. Similarly, for the spring time, we do the same trick to look at the summer stars. We don't try this during the summer to look at the autumn sky, with the exception of the Perseid meteor shower, because the whole night is going to be soaked in summer weather. Similarly, in the winter, we're not looking for spring stars in the winter, we'll just have a long sleep in until the equinox, the spring equinox. Okay, so who's up there? In the high north, that is, you have to turn around and face north, we have El Daramen near the top of the map, which indicates the stars of Cepheus. Now we have Kaf, which is one of the stars in Cassiopeia. And those who've been watching these seminars or come to my in-person talks before COVID, I label stars because that's what you see in the sky. You don't see stick figures. You don't see frontiers like on a map of your state with the county boundaries on it. You just don't see that. you know when you go from county to county when you're driving, because the road conditions suddenly change. The county you entered takes care of its road, and they're nice and smooth. The one you left was a washboard. But in the sky, you don't have those clues. And since what you see are points, those are what I labeled. And I labeled some stars in Pegasus, Enif, and Merkab near the center of the picture, and Alpheratz, which is actually in Andromeda for the square of Pegasus. About halfway up in the south, which is a kind of an empty area of the sky, no bright stars, there are several asterisms, but no bright stars, we have the two big planets which would be with us all through the rest of the fall and into winter, Saturn, which is the dimmer and western of the pair, and Jupiter, the brighter and eastern of the pair. Now, I'm not going to discuss those two here because we had separate lessons a couple of sessions ago for Jupiter and for Saturn. If you missed them or you want to review them again, go back to the AV files page and pull down the files for Jupiter in 2022 and for Saturn in 2022. Stars in the south near the southern horizon. Fourmilhaut, which is an Arabic name. Some people try to give it a French twist to the sounding, but it's Fourmilhaut, three words, mouth, four of fish, H-O-U-T being some kind of a fish in Arabic, or the English can mulching up of the Arabic. In the east, near the Pleiades, a brilliant reddish star, Mars. It entered our midnight and pre-midnight late night sky in early September, and it will be with us all through the winter while we have the opposition, and going into spring when it starts to fade and go into the evening twilight. So if you haven't picked up Mars in night as opposed to seeing him in the morning, now is the time to start looking for him. Right now, mid-September, he is still heading eastward, that is, on this map, toward the left. That is, he'll move out of the line of the Hyades and Pleiades, and during October he'll slow down and enter his retrograde loop. We have a distinct lesson for Mars for the first session of October. So I'll just highlight Mars and let you chomp at the bit, marking the days on your calendar for that first Friday in October. Now, the autumn gives us two fascinating groups of constellations. One appears to be entirely a chance placement of these constellations in the same quadrant of the sky, each having its own story and legends, but they all are associated with the open sea or ocean. The second group of constellations also gathered together in one part of the sky are part of one large story, and throughout the heavens, it is the only such deliberately aggregated constellations related in one story. You went to the next slide already? You went to the next slide too? Slide 6, which is a portrait view with north up, west on the right, east on the left, and south downward. It's not a horizon or landscape view. These are the constellations, and I put up the mythical creatures, the dashed, stylized outlines. Those constellations, which are named, represent the sea in English, and in Spanish it's the océano or el mar, what comes from the Latin words ocean or sea. All of these, even though the stories for each do not relate to each other, are in fact ocean related. The ecliptic runs there, slanting from the upper left to lower right, and we start with those. On the right side, west of the ecliptic, is Capricornus. Next east is Aquarius. And up near the top there is Pisces. Near the upper right corner, we have Delphinus, the dolphin. And now we go down toward the bottom of the chart, starting from the lower left corner, Eridanus, the river, and different stories equated to one or another of the rivers in the classical world. And then coming to the right, Cetus, the sea monster, and then Pisces austrinus, the southern fish. Now down near the margin, bottom margin, is the constellation Grus, G-R-U-S, which is the name of a bird that lives in shallow waters. And actually, the behavior of that bird in dipping down its long neck to pick up food and bring it up before he starts to chew it gave the name crane. And actually, crane, the construction device, comes from the behavior of that bird. So those are the constellations of the sea. And again, no one could ever figure out how they ended up being in this part of the sky. The other group of constellations in slide 7 are those in the Andromeda story. Now, I won't bore you to tears, because I'm sure all of you who show the autumn stars to the public or the newer members of your club tell the story and probably recite it in your sleep. Every stargazing book includes it. But these are those constellations near the top of the map, which is also a portrait view. You have Cepheus, again with the caricatures in dotted outline, and Cassiopeia, Cepheus and Cassiopeia. And then in the middle of the map is the star of the show, Andromeda, and to her left, toward the left, is Perseus. In the lower center is Cetus, and then toward the right side is Pegasus. So those are the constellations. The only other part of the sky where the constellations in juxtaposition that belong to the same story that I can think of is Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. They're classical stories, not the newer ones, say like in the Native Americans, but the classical ones that show they were both put there pretty much together. Now there's some other constellations which are related, but not necessarily together. Well, okay, I thought of another one. Hercules and Draco. Hercules is kneeling upside down on the head of Hercules, and he's going to whack him with his club. Hercules killing a certain dragon was one of the chores that he had to accomplish. But otherwise, I think that's about it. Let me just make a quick look. Okay, nothing there, nothing there. Okay, if anyone thinks of another where two constellations together belong in the same story, okay, Aquarius and Pisces Sestrinus. Well, if you go back to slide 6, you will see that the water that Aquarius is pouring goes into the mouth of the southern fish. But I haven't heard of a story that relates the two together. That just may be a pictorial representation of two distinct legends, but as long as the Aquarius was pouring water and the southern fish was in that part of the sky, they might have drawn with his mouth open, drinking up the water. But it's a good guess. Thank you. 8, 9, and 10 are pretty intriguing. I'm not going to go through a list of deep sky objects to look at. And, oh, look at this such and such nebula. Oh, look at this such and such galaxy. And rattle off some stupid facts and figures. No, I'm not doing that. But I do want to impress on you why the deep sky objects are scattered in the sky the way they are. You probably are aware that certain constellations have more galaxies than others, certain have more open clusters than others, and so on. But these three, starting with 8, is an all-sky view. The circle is the horizon, compass points marked around it, and the sweeping arc through it is the galactic equator. It's the base of the galactic coordinate system, or nearly enough, is the center line of the Milky Way band in the sky. What's inside that circle is above the horizon, invisible, and this is just for a schematic fall night. And then the anything outside, which I didn't bother trying to erase, is simply not visible. It's below the horizon. This first one, speckled with little symbols looking like rifle crosshairs, are globular clusters. And they're scattered pretty much all over the sky. There aren't that many to begin with. There's only about 400 known in all. Of about 150 would be in range, both hemispheres, in small home telescopes. Now the reason they're scattered pretty much all over is if you look at the structure of the Milky Way with the plane, that's the crawler structure, and the globular clusters are in a cloud or shell that surround it, seemingly about equally distributed all over. So no matter where we look, we'll see a smattering of these globular clusters. And this is true in all seasons, not just the autumn. And by the way, if you want to compare what happens in other seasons, go back to the AV Files page and get the lessons for winter and spring and summer. That is the one, the last seasonal view, previews of the sky. And there will be a set of slides like this, appropriate to that session, and the narration will explain why the DSOs appear in the different parts of the sky. But here we're doing autumn. So there's no real bias, if you will, of the globular clusters relative to the Milky Way. You may see fewer along the Milky Way because dust and gas obstruct our view outside. We'll see this in slide 10. Niner shows the same sky view, and incidentally, I label the few stars with the first three letters of their names to avoid clutter. And there's the arc of the galactic equator, and this time with small dotted circles are open clusters. Open clusters almost completely hug the Milky Way. So if you're looking for open clusters, troll along the Milky Way. And it doesn't matter much which season, the area of the Milky Way is filled with these, and it could pay an evening of enjoyment to just lay in a lawn chair and slowly track along the Milky Way, and you'll be bumping into open cluster upon open cluster upon open cluster. So the open clusters, there are a couple of exemptions. Okay, you have the Hyades and the Pleiades, which are not in the Milky Way band, and that's because they are so extremely close to us, only a couple hundred light years, that they, by perspective, are angrily away. But any cluster at a distance, say 1,000 light years or more, they are along that Milky Way band. Also along that band, although I didn't specifically plot them, are globular nebulae, the remains of novae when the star puffs off its outer shell and leaves a roughly globular gas dust envelope around it, and also open nebulae from which stars themselves are formed. So those three, open clusters, open nebulae, globular nebulae, all relate to the life cycle of a star, and where are the stars most populous? Along the Milky Way band. Slide 10 shows the distribution of galaxies, those tiny little ellipse symbols. Now, because galaxies are outside the Milky Way, somewhat like the globular clusters, and they are distributed roughly uniformly all over the heavens, you can look anywhere and see galaxies. There are two anomalies. Along the band of the Milky Way, the galaxies thin out. And that's because of the gas dust in the Milky Way. That's what gives the Milky Way that structure, curly, milky appearance. The gas dust simply blocks the light of galaxies from reaching us, so there's like an erased band where galaxies, in the old days before we realized what they really were excluded. Also, in the southern sky, about a third of the way up toward the zenith, the symbols are so close and bunched together they make a solid green patch, because in that direction, in Cetus, and in the constellation Sculpture, which is just south of Cetus, is an actual cluster of galaxies comparable to the Virgo cluster of galaxies in our spring sky. This is the Sculpture group. Most of its galaxies are within range of small home telescopes, and maybe five or six are caught within New York City. So if you're looking for galaxies in the fall, anywhere away from the Milky Way band, and especially toward the border of Cetus and Sculpture. So that's how we find the DSOs. And okay, now you know what types of DSOs can you look for in a particular season or month, and whereabouts relative to the Milky Way you can find them. Well, which one should you look for? Slide 11, please. You pull down from our website the file DSO-NY. The entire link is on the title page, and that categorizes a very healthy selection of DSOs. There's sections for each category of object, and then within each section or category, they're arranged by constellation. So the bands running across this snippet for double stars separates constellations. Now the meanings of the columns are at the top, off the top of the picture, but here for double stars, well, the first two give you the name of the star, then you have the right ascension declination, the magnitude of the two components, the separation in arc seconds, and the colors of the two components. And because binary stars are in orbital motion, their spacing apart will vary with time, and the last column therefore is the year for which the other data are valid. In this case, or in this article, the colors are the schematic ones based on spectral class. They are not necessarily the colors you will see in the eyepiece. If you ask 10 observers what color are those two stars, you get 10 different answers. That is, a star may look kind of blue, but one will say deep blue, sky blue, robin's egg blue, sky blue, slate blue, and so on. And the spectral class could be typical of a schematic color blue, but that's what you got there, the schematic colors. And like I say, this is a snippet from the segment on double stars within that DSO-NY article. It's a pretty lengthy one, but you can use it as a breadbasket to pick out objects of opportunity for your own star viewing. We now turn to a rather new, or newer, deep sky object, or target of interest, which came into the home astronomy world in the mid-1990s. That is, a generation ago. That is the planetary star. Stars which have their own planets. The planets are called extrasolar planets or exoplanets. The reason they came into the home astronomy world is that many of them, around 110 by now, 2022, are bare ice stars, most being part of a constellation figure, and many are among the brighter stars in the sky. That is, you can actually point to an obvious star and say, that one has its own planets. And you can chit-chat about the details of the planets. So, this slide 12 is a snippet from the file PlanStar, noted on the title page. It lists the 110-ish bare-eye planetary stars in order of right ascension, and where a star has more than one planet, such as the couple in this picture, the star data is not repeated, but the information for the planets are given on successive rows. The headings are at the top of the list, so you really have to get the file for yourself. But let's say the middle star, this guy in Cassiopeia, which has a Henry Draper number, even though it is about 6 magnitude, has 7 or 8 planets. So the last 4 columns give the, in turn, the mass of the planet in Jupiter units, the semi-major axis of the orbit in Earth-Sun units, and the orbital period in Earth days, and finally, the year that the planet was announced. This file is separate from the DSO file because it is routinely updated with new discovered planetary stars within naked eye reach. That's why we have up to 110. And also this covers both hemispheres, and it is arranged in order of right ascension rather than grouped by constellation. So be sure when you do your star viewing with your club members or the public, leaf through this for the right ascension bands that's in your sky. Pick out a couple, maybe 3, of the planetary stars and point them out where they're all bright, and muse to yourself and with the others, we're looking up at them. Are the people on those planets looking back at us? All right, we retreat back to our solar system in slide 13. And this is the timeline for the 4 months for the moon. You have dates on the left from September 21st or so down to the, in the lower left corner, late December. So that's the fall season. And across the top are the hours of the day, and that is in standard time. And at the bottom, hours of the day in universal time. We have 2 pairs of wavy lines. On the left side, you have a wavy line, the leftmost, the one against the white area, is sunset, and the inner one against the dark middle of the picture is end of twilight. And on the right hand side, we have another pair of wavy lines, beginning of twilight and then sunrise. Note carefully that we passed the solstice and you see the sunset occurring as the weeks go by down the page, earlier and earlier on the clock, either UT or Eastern Standard. And then actually around the end of the period in late December, the days sort of slow down and start to reach the shortest day or earliest arrival of night, because that's near the winter solstice. Okay, within the body of the chart, we see horizontal bars, which represent these period when the moon is above the horizon. The left end of each bar is moon rise, and the right end of each bar is moon set. So where the moon set is in twilight or right after sunset, you have a very small moon near or right after new moon. Where you see the moon rising near sunset and remaining in the sky for most of the night, that's a large moon near full moon. And if you get some nights where you have essentially no moon, the moon sets right after or just before sunset and rises pretty much near sunrise, that is your dark moon period. And then where the visibility of the moon runs all night, that's close to your full moon or other very large moon. So this chart helps you plan for nights of dark or full or large or bright moon. Of course, if you're studying the moon, you want the moon in the sky. So it depends what you're looking for. But that is how the moon circulates through the hours of the clock during the 4 months. I have a diagram similar to this with the same interpretation for the planet Venus in due course. Autumn 2022 brings us a lunar eclipse, the second for the United States in this year. So slide 14 gives the timetable in the form of a time-lapse drawing of the moon as it moves through the shadow of the Earth. All the times are universal time, which in November 8th, the 7th and 8th, depending on your time zone, you are in standard time within the United States. And what they're doing in the Malvinas Islands, I don't know. And you have now the two end ones, the farthest right picture and farthest left picture, are unobservable events because they are the contact with the outer edge of the moon's penumbra. And we'll have a special lesson about the eclipse for the second session of October. Then you have the touching of the moon to the umbra, the full immersion of the moon, mid-eclipse, beginning to leave, going right to left, final, completely left the moon, the umbra, and that is the end of the eclipse. And if you look at the times, it lasts many hours. On the east coast of the U.S., including the New York Skies region, the eclipse occurs in the pre-dawn hours, and the eclipse is still in progress at sunrise. We will have the visibility of an eclipsing moon while the sun is shining on the landscape in front of the moon. And that is a strong or hard selenohelion, that is a lunar eclipse in progress, that is the umbra is on the moon, even if partially, while the sun is still in the sky. And that can be one at sunset with the moon in the east, or at sunrise, as we'll have this time, with the moon in the west. Farther into the U.S. and going to the west coast, the entire eclipse is visible in dark sky and is mostly or fully complete by the time dawn comes. The visibility of this eclipse over the entire world is shown in picture 15. The white area in the middle is where there is no eclipse. It occurs during local daytime with the moon below the local horizon, and that's the Atlantic Ocean and most of Europe and Africa. To the left, that is west, you see the United States, Quebec, Canada, Mexico, and much of South America do get the eclipse. The extreme east coast, the eclipse is still going on at moonset, which can occur, depending on the latitude you're on, will be right before, or actually right after sunrise. So the sun will come up, and then you have a few minutes to see the eclipsed moon before it sets. And then on the right-hand side, the Pacific Ocean, the Taiwan, Japan, the two Koreas, Kamchatka, Australia, New Zealand, Philippines, they get the eclipse in their morning sky. That is, they'll get a selenohelion, that is the border between the white and dark area in the sun setting when the moon is coming up in eclipse. We have two occultations by the moon of planets. The one on October 24th, shown in figure 16, will probably be unobservable by ordinary observing techniques. It occurs by chance on or right next to the superior conjunction of Venus. So this simulation, skyscape view with zenith up, or the horizon is horizontal near the bottom, you have near the bottom the sun with Venus next to him. That's the superior conjunction. Venus is on the far side of the sun. And about 10 degrees west along the ecliptic, we have the moon about to cover the planet Mercury. But of course, this will occur in intense twilight if the time zone puts the sun below the horizon, or in full daylight, like on the east coast of the U.S. In daylight. So it may be unobservable. However, there may be a college or a university observatory with the proper equipment and offering views of the occultation. They may do it by video means, where the telescope has special filtration and imaging devices, and then you sit in a lecture room or a classroom and see it projected on a screen. So do ask around. The other occultation is visible at night over most of the United States, as we'll see in slide 17. On December 8th, the same day as the Mars opposition, Mars is occulted by the Moon. And we'll detail this event next session where we deal with the planet Mars. But substantially, over most of the United States and most of the western part of Canada and northern Mexico, again in our hemisphere, we will see a normal, very spectacular occultation of Mars as it goes behind a almost completely full moon. On the east coast and in the Gulf Coast, we'll see a good conjunction of Mars and the moon, with Mars passing to the south. Near the border, like in the New York skies region, we see a close miss, as this scene shows for New York City. And a little farther north, about, let's say, in the Massachusetts, the upper Hudson River Valley, Delaware Water Gap, and then in Pennsylvania, we will have a graze where Mars kisses the southern edge of the moon, and through a telescope it will look like it's scudding along, peeping out between the mountains on that limb as a graze occultation. But a close miss if, let's say, you're in southern New England, Long Island, New York City, central and southern New Jersey, or in the Schuylkill, Pennsylvania, what's that big town? Philadelphia. In that area, in our region, we'll get a very beautiful close miss. And you can actually see how the moon slides by Mars. Of course, the motion is a bit exaggerated because Mars is flying westward in a retrograde loop while the moon is rushing eastward. So you got very good photo ops for that. Again, the details next session. Okay, in 18, we have a timeline for Venus. And Venus is substantially unobservable in the fall. But I put this in because in late October, around October 24th, if you saw that picture of the Mercury occultation, Venus goes into superior conjunction. And in this timeline, the same layout as for the moon, except that the bars represent the rising and setting of Venus. So near the beginning of the fall, where we are now, mid-September for the seminar date, and then next week is the equinox, we see that Venus is rising sooner and sooner before the sun, dipping into twilight. And there around the middle of the picture in late October, it rises with the sun. That's the conjunction. Then you flip over to the left side at sunset, and we see Venus is starting to set later and later after the sun. And by the end of fall, we may see it peeping over the skylight between trees or along alleys right after sunset to begin her evening apparition. And we'll have Venus in the sky all winter and well into the spring of 2023. I'm not mentioning Jupiter and Saturn. You saw them on the general sky map in High South. And anything I have to say about those planets were taken care of in the sessions, Jupiter in 2022 and Saturn in 2022. And if you missed them or you want to do them again, share them with your friends, pluck them down from the AV Files page. I already mentioned Mars, but I just had to throw in slide 19 to sort of get your juices flowing for the opposition and retrograde motion of Mars in this fall. So slide 19 is a tracing of the retrograde loop. Mars enters the field with the Hyades, Pleiades, and Taurus from the right, goes through the loop, and then leaves off on the left. And we'll explore this in a little more detail next session, but that's something to sort of look for. Mars is, if you go back to the general sky chart at the beginning of the session, is already in our night sky. It's near the Pleiades. So be sure to go out and look for it and follow it now. Don't wait until the beginning of October for our Mars session. Follow, at least in binoculars, now. Besides the bare eye planets, we do have Uranus. That's a binocular field object, and this chart on slide 20 shows the path of the planet for roughly a 10-year period, with 2022 into 2023 kind of in the middle of the picture. It goes through retrograde loops, but they're all flattened out because Uranus has a very small inclination with the ecliptic. So the loops are really just seesawing back and forth, one step back, two forward, one step back, two forward, year by year. But he's bouncing around in Aries and Taurus, and if you have in your planetarium program a seventh magnitude star limit, you should have no problem picking out Uranus from those stars. He's sixth magnitude pretty much consistently all through his apparition. So please do look for Uranus if you get a chance. We may have a bright comet by the end of the year. It's comet ZTF, Zulu Tango Foxtrot, which is the abbreviation for some outfit called Zwicky Transfer Facility. And I just don't know what that is. But that outfit, whatever it is, made a discovery. It actually found two comets, and I'll point that out in a sec. This is comet 2022 E Echo 3, and this is the orbital elements, so you can punch them into your planetarium program, the page or dialog box for add new comet, define orbit, custom object, or some such. It has a very, very slightly hyperbolic orbit. Now, if your program does not accept eccentricity greater than 1, and some of the older programs do not, because the maths of a hyperbolic orbit are rather different from those of elliptical or parabolic. So all the new ones built that algorithm in. So try keying in the eccentricity, and if it coughs, put in 1, and you won't be all that far off. It'll actually be essentially spot on for the short run from now to the end of the year. Now, the reason I point this out is, right now it's around 11th magnitude, no one paying much attention to it, but it has a very, very steep expected rise in brightness so that by the end of the year, it could be in naked eye range and reasonably certainly in binocular range. You will have to separately assess the location in the sky and the amount of sky illumination, typically from twilight. But those are the orbit elements. Just punch them in as they are named there. The expected brightness light curve for comet ZTF is shown in slide 22. Okay, now be careful. There is another ZTF comet. Well, these automated bulk sweeping of the sky for asteroids also traps comets. So there are hundreds of Lanier comets, Pan-STAR comets, Atlas comet, Nail-Rise comets, NEAT comets. But in this particular instance, comet 22E3 is the second comet discovered by this ZTF company. The first one was comet 2021E3. The designation by chance happened to be very similar, but one year apart. They're both discovered in the first half of March in 2021 and in 2022. The earlier one already peaked in the late spring at ninth magnitude and is of no further interest to the casual observer. So make sure when you collect news about comet ZTF, it's the one in the year 2022. And you see the points already for observed brightness seem to be staying on or even a little above the expected light curve. This doesn't mean you should get your hopes up that strongly, because comets can fizzle out, explode and evaporate, or they could enhance their luminosity and get bright earlier. See, so please keep your news channels open for 2022 E3 during this fall season. Okay, we pass on to slide 23. We'll see what the meteor showers are doing. There are 32 slides in this exercise, so we're kind of two-thirds of the way through. Okay, this chart shows, it's actually radio reflection measurements, but they do track visual meteor counts. You have to count on the left, which is probably a composite from many of these radio reflection stations and probably normalized, and you have the dates across the bottom. Meteor activity begins in the spring, April, May, with, say, the Lyrid meteor shower. That's the little blip, LYR. And they continue, they have the Aquarius, then you have some others in between. Not every meteor shower is labeled, but the biggie, which we had in August, is the Perseids in August, P-E-R, that's that big spike. Then there are several others, the unnamed ones are the Taurids, the Orionids, the Draconids, probably some others, and then we go to the Novemberish, the Leonids, that's L-E-O. They're at an ebb for the next 10 or so years, awaiting an expected resurgence and storm in 2032, 2033. And then toward the end of the year, mid-December, another giant peak, GEM, the Geminids. And that's the one which I'll highlight now. I'm not having a special session because the one for the Perseids contains all the information about meteor showers in general that you want to know about. So if you're doing a presentation for the Geminids or highlighting them, you may want to play for your club the Perseid lesson that was in the late September, late July, and then slap over that the next couple of these slides, or independent data regarding the Geminids. But that's a very interesting track of the meteor activity. So if you start in the spring, we go to December, you roll over to the next year, you're back at the left side, we have the quadrantids, Q-U-A, which is also a reasonably good meteor shower. A general description of the Geminid plus factors to consider in observing them are given in slide 24, and you may want to capture that and study it. The moon will be close to last quarter, meaning that it will rise roughly midnight in the mid-northern latitudes. Now the Geminids are a little unusual in that the radiant gets into high sky during the pre-midnight through midnight hours. Most of your showers, such as the Perseids, you have to wait until the owl hours for the radiant to rise, and then you observe from then on into dawn. But the Geminids, you can start observing them in the late evening, early night, and you can continue to roughly midnight when the last quarter moon comes along. That may wash out the dimmer meteors, but the Geminids do throw down a good percent of fireballs or otherwise bright meteors. So you may get a reasonably good shower rate, meteors per hour, nevertheless. And where they mentioned in this thing, the GHR, it's a Zulu Hotel Romeo, that's zenith hour rate of 120 meteors per hour. That's an idealized rate which no single observer can expect to see. A good observer, alert, lots of no-dos in his eyes, with an open sky exposure, and relaxed, he can see in a dark, clear sky, no moon, could see half of what the stated ZHR is. So 60 meteors is probably the most that you could expect to see. And by the way, that includes the dim ones, fourth and fifth magnitude, where you get into the realm of, did I really see it, kind of meteor. So that's the details in verbal form for the Geminids. The Geminids radiate from near the star Castor, so it's easy to know where to look for the radiant, using, of course, the little trick that explained for the Perseids of not staring only into western Gemini, or eastern Gemini, I should say, but look elsewhere, look in Taurus, look in Auriga, look in Orion, look in Hydra, Leo, that is 30 to 50-ish degrees away every so often to keep your head on a swivel. The radiant drifts, like almost all of them do. If you observe before the peak of December 14th, the radiant would be a little west of Castor, And if you observe later, in the 20s of December, you have the radiant east. And beyond the endpoints, the Earth has, from the west, didn't yet enter the meteor stream, or on the east end, at the end of the time period, has left it. So you might keep that in mind when looking for the Geminids. In this fall, 2022, solar activity remains high, and slide 26 shows the expected activity in the solid smooth curve, and the jagged one gives the sunspot observed counts. It's a homogenized sunspot number on the left, and dates running are on the bottom. The peak is expected in 2024-2025, but already in late 2022, the sunspot count, which is a figure of merit for the general jiving up of solar activity, is approaching the expected next peak and is challenging the activity of the previous peak back in the late 2010s. This means, among other things, that we already have had this year disruptions of communications, of navigation, data transmissions, satellite operations, and also a little bit on the Earth, electric power glitches, and a few northern light displays. Now, so far, these have been in the northern tier, like the Great Lakes and northern New England of the United States, but they could creep down, even momentarily for a night or two, to the mid-north latitudes, which say southern New England, Long Island, New York City, the Pennsylvania, the Appalachian region, and maybe the mountain state, Montana, Wyoming. You can't tell for sure, but as long as the nights are getting longer, they're starting a little earlier on the clock, and there's enough nights with dark moon, please, at least in the evening and midnight hours, please, when you're doing any other observing, swing around to the north and scan for northern lights. You must know the normal illuminations that the ground activity, terrestrial goings-on, can throw into the sky and fool you to think that there's northern lights. And there was a session, I think it was last year, back on the AV files page for observing the northern lights. So all the this and that and ins and outs and ups and downs are there. But I summarize them in the next two slides. 27 is a snapshot of the aurora oval, the area within which northern lights are most probable. Not that they really see them, but the influx of the electrons coming down from the sun is densest along that ring. And we see that it's very irregular in the 11 o'clock position, the way this picture is oriented, there's a gap with probably low activity chance. And on the 4 to 6 o'clock area, which is in the Quebec and Canada region, the density is highest. So this is, of course, a snapshot from a single particular day in August, and you should go to a space weather website. A publication won't do any good, because by the time it's printed and distributed and comes in your mailbox, all the activity is out of date. So go to a space weather website And you can use the one by NOAA, which has a enthusiast dashboard website, or you can go to spaceweather.com, and there's some others. You might even try those from other countries. The National Geophysics Department would do the same, and it would give you all kinds of information, including the current rover Aurora oval status. Now in 28, I give you a little cue card, because the chances of an aurora depend on your geomagnetic latitude, not geographic, but geomagnetic latitude. And there are two common schemes. One is the KP, Kilo Papa, and the other is the NOAA activity level. Either one is just as good. So whichever one your aurora news source offers, use it. And you look up your geomagnetic latitude in the appropriate column. You can interpolate in between. And if the index is equal to or greater than what's noted here, then you have a chance, or a higher chance, of seeing aurora. So far, so good. But how do you know your geomagnetic latitude? Well, geophysical websites will give you this. Usually it's a map, and you spot your town in that map according to the geomagnetic grid. That's centered on the geomagnetic pole, which is in the northern part of Canada, some, I don't know, 1,000 or so kilometers south, well, everything is south, toward the United States. So the geomagnetic latitudes for U.S. towns tend to be greater numerically than the geographic. So the next picture, 29, are skeleton lists of towns around the world which you can use as a guide or starting point. Okay, that 29 is a little scanty, but for us in New York Sky, New York is shown to have a geomag latitude of 50 and a half. So therefore, when I get a report of a projected KP index of 12, I can go to the previous slide, look up 50 and a half or the closest to it, and see, is 12 greater than the minimum KP for that latitude? And yes, it is. So I better pray for clear skies and no moon. And if the car sales lot doesn't have cheap used cars for sale, so he's washing the sky with searchlights, or the gangs on the next hood are not using flashbang grenades, then I could probably look for northern lights. You should also know from a geophysical map the direction preferentially where the northern lights will occur. Now in the New York Skies area, this tends to be about 30 degrees to the right of geographical north. So you will start there and you sweep that whole quadrant, taking careful note of illuminations which look terrestrial, and you should be aware of them. And then the, those rays are really darting. You got an aurora. Again, this is the fall season, longer nights, more pleasant weather, drier, clearer air, and the continued very high solar activity. Okay, remember I mentioned way back in the general star chart and also in the suspended summer's supplemental article that the summer stars seem to hang around. Of course, not, in other words, the diurnal rotation of the, not the year, but the daily creeping, seasonal drift of the stars seems to slow down in the fall, so that the summer stars, highlighted by the summer triangle, seem to take longer to disappear in twilight than, say, stars in the spring, which seem to just zoom away when you approach the March equinox. Well, among the features in the west is the summer reach of the Milky Way, shown here in slide 30. And this shows it's kind of coming out of the southwest, heading up into the high sky past Deneb, and then overhead. Beyond the top of the picture, the Milky Way thins out because we then are looking outward in our galaxy away from the center to the thinly populated outboard spiral arm. Now that Milky Way, certainly in a gray sky area, probably will never be seen. But the summer part can, in an illuminated sky, when the air is really clear and dark, as they can be in a northeast fall away from hurricane. Actually, once a hurricane moves through, it swept everything out. So you could get some spectacularly clear sky. The summer Milky Way could be spotted. And the article on the title page, Milky-NY, explains how to prepare for this. So right now in New York skies, we are in the winter, well, not the winter, autumn window for spotting the Milky Way. That's September, October, and November. By the time December comes around, although we still have some of the summer Milky Way in Cygnus visible, the weather turns rotten and lousy, and the chances zero out. So that's an activity for us in the city, and you may want to adapt that as an observing project if you live in a gray sky region elsewhere. Okay, another observing project is shown in slide 31. Fall for New York skies begins its annual campaign for Globe at Night. The Globe at Night actually is a worldwide project to collect observed transparency of the sky during the dark moon periods each month, and it runs all year round. It picks, depending on the season, a target constellation with a good variety of star brightnesses, some in the north, some in the southern hemisphere, and you simply inspect it at least once a night, which is really enough for beginners. You make a note of the sky condition, the hour and the day, and the dimmest star clearly visible in that constellation. Now, New York skies stays with Orion, which is one of the Globe at Night constellations, and Orion comes into the late night, midnight sky in November. So starting in November, we will be watching Orion and using a chart like this, which one matches best the view of Orion, and the number of the chart is the limiting magnitude. You really only can get this to a whole magnitude. And you make a written note, maybe in a log sheet or even a spreadsheet or a database, night by night during the dark moon periods. When November comes around, I'll remind you folk of it, and I'll post the dates in the NICE events, NYC events page. If you go to our homepage on the website, one of the jump words is NYC events, and you pull up the current issue, which right now is September. And when the November one comes in, a new entry will be added for Globe at Night with the dark moon dates that the Globe at Night office establishes. So that begins in November and runs through April, when Orion is moved into the twilight. And I know in some of my own observations, the ones in April, sometimes I had to note that there's strong, the twilight or Orion is getting too low. Okay, last slide, concluding our lesson. Ha ha. We go back, slide 32. That's right, slide 32. We go back to standard time. And this happens on November 6th, 2 o'clock in the morning. That is the hour that would be 2 o'clock in daylight time, snaps back to 1 o'clock standard time. So the hour 1 through 159 repeats. And when it hits 2 o'clock the second time, that's in standard time, you then run forward into the 2 o'clock hour, 3 o'clock hour, and so on, until next spring. What I want you to do is keep your eye on the news regarding proposed changes in the daylight savings time regimen in the United States. Remember, the daylight saving time is not a natural phenomenon, but it's a adjudicated legislative act, certainly for the United States. And it can be altered pretty much at will. The effective date would be, say, the following year or two ahead. So a proposal banging around in the U.S. Congress is to stay on daylight time continuously. That is, in November 2023, when we would go back in November of that year, we simply leave the clocks alone and we run all of our affairs 1 hour on the clock ahead of your normal zone time. Well, that happened. It's still being debated and hashed out, all kinds of horse trading and whatever. So please bear in mind. But for this year, 2022, on November 6th, that 2 o'clock in the morning, we snap back to standard time. And people make a little game of it. If they have a, they look at their computer clock or the clock on their cell phone, and they watch the time tick up, 157, 158, 159, boom, 100, 101, 002, 03, up to 159 again, then 200, 201, 203, and so on. So that's a little game that some of us like to play. Okay, we have a quiz for you. Go back to slide 19, the one that shows the retrograde loop for Mars. It'll give you something to play with before the next session, beginning of October. You see the shape of that loop? There's the eastern side, this is West Station, we'll worry about that next time, it's nice and rounded, and the end near the Pleiades, where Mars comes out of the loop, is kind of pointed, as if the planet were bouncing off a wall. So the quiz for you is, are the retrograde loops always the same shape, like this, or do they vary from opposition to opposition? And if they do vary, is there a pattern or rhythm to the variations, so that if I knew when an opposition was coming, can I anticipate somehow what the loop will look like? So that is the quiz. I'll answer it within the lesson, where there'll be no preliminary picture or two before the title slide, because that's such an important point in Mars observing. I devote a little segment to the shape of the retrograde loops. But you could play with this on your planetarium program, you know, look up various oppositions and see what the loops look like and see if you can detect any rhyme or reason to them. So until next time, pray for clear skies.